Et spirit. This period of time is a period for some quenched questions and answers. I'll endeavor to respond to any questions that may have during the days that we've been here together. It's been reasonably broad exploration. You have, of course, addressed the importance of being a mindful, conscious human being and bringing mindfulness to the small and everyday events and circumstances. Spoke about meditation and with the instructions, concentration for deepening one's capacity to be with an object well and clearly. The small groups with that open format of various explorations of themes and issues which are important to our lives. And of course, the inquiries as well, the morning meditation instructions, the afternoon teachings that the three of us have been given. So in the fullness of the time that we've been here together, much has been touched upon. And of course, sometimes from that, some areas of interest, some questions arise for you, perhaps directly related to these days here. Of course, just a small reminder again that tomorrow morning, the three of us will be speaking about the transitions into daily life, and our intention is, of course, to cover those areas as much as possible. So please do feel free to ask anything you might wish to ask, and that may be, of course, from the hours and the days and the events taking place here, and sometimes there are other larger issues as well in the spiritual, religious, social, political, global area. Dharma has a voice on pretty well anything. This one does anyway. So just feel free to ask the question, if possible, if your good voice could extend so others can hear. I know it's a little difficult for some, and just I'll pick up the question and then I'll endeavour to repeat it before responding. So anyone who would like to ask anything? Yes, sir.
I have, you talked about the incident of your grandson.
The incident of the grandson, or the violent attack.
Violent.
Yeah, yes.
I wonder, how do you deal with the revenge, the feeling of revenge? Because you say that, I think where this young boy grew up, and if I was in some kind of situation like this, and I don't think about where this guy came from, I don't care, I want to revenge.
Mm.
Now, this feeling of revenge is going with me all the time,
yes.
Even when I wake up in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
So what is your way of dealing with this kind of? I'm sure I suppose that you have this kind of thing in your mind, maybe, or maybe your daughter have this kind of revenge somehow. But how do you deal in the Dharma way?
So the question is in response to the violence that this gang inflicted on my grandson, and sometimes the outcome of that, as you point out, is the desire for revenge. The desire for revenge, my concern with it, it repeats exactly the same behavior. it to inflict the suffering on the other, so that oneself as a human being has reduced oneself to the level of the other person. I don't want to live like that. So in looking at the responses to the issues which are around us, and therefore the violence in this case, there is no point in taking a kind of passive acceptance of the behavior of another human being. But if I don't want to sink so low as to inflict violence on the other, if I don't want to reduce my humanity to that, then I need to feel a passionate concern about the circumstances. I need to take all the necessary steps that the judiciary, the criminal justice system, will allow. I need to see what way that this situation can be resolved, both for the safety of the family, the grandson, for his friends, one of whom was also violently beaten up, and in that determination to do that doesn't carry revenge. It doesn't carry any wish to inflict violence upon the other, but it is engaging in a due process to hold responsibility and to see what necessary steps are for that person to be held accountable with responsibility under the law. That's the position. Short. If you wish, you're welcome, but short.
Sure, yes. Short question. You wrote in the book about awakening. You wrote full realization of the ultimate truth.
Yes.
Each one has his own truth. What is the ultimate truth?
The ultimate truth is that each one doesn't have their own truth. I mean it.
What was the question?
The question was a response to one of the one lines that I had put in the paper on the notice board with a brief reference to ultimate truth. And the good questionnaire here said or asked, everybody has their own truth. What is the ultimate truth? And my response is, which is the answer, that is, nobody has their own truth. That's the ultimate truth. And it's worthwhile, it's a serious answer, not a clever one. It genuinely is worthwhile meditating on it. Really.
Thank you.
Yes, please.
My question is a bit of an extension on the previous question.
Yes.
Thinking, for instance, politically, if you want to create social change, and necessarily is there a justice system,
yes,
and law. And it sounds like we could all be very mindful about situations that bother us and be very caring about it, but sometimes it needs, sometimes like maybe the anger produces a protest that's more powerful than mindfulness and clarity about the situation. How to change something without the power that comes with the revenge, with the anger, with for example, my Palestinian friends will say it's very nice that we're clear about the occupation, but what do we do about it if we're just going to pick up signs and nothing's ever going to change? So I'm wondering.
All right. So did people hear the question? Okay. A good friend, Leah here, she very kindly subscribes to Aretz, your daily newspaper.
Haaretz.
Haaretz.
How's your friend?
Haaretz. Oh, yeah. It's nicer more, Aretz.
Yeah.
It's nicer
Aretz.
Yeah.
You see my appalling pronunciation of the Hebrew, that it once got me into a bit of trouble, a landing here. Because I arrived at the foreigner's arrival desk with the passport, and as they say the mantra, "What is the purpose of your visit?" And I said, "I've come for hummus." And the immigration officer, because of my poor pronunciation, thought I said, "I've come for Hamas." He looked very shocked. So apologies for my very poor Hebrew. So, just to get back to your good question here, I quite agree, but with the difference. Yes, I do think it is important to be mindful of the situation. And the reason I mentioned the newspaper is I was reading there, and also in the British press, more or less, I don't belong to the left, I just want to make that clear, that the left is leaving Israel and taking a flight to Berlin, in summary. So just to let you know that those of you who are on the left, just to let you know, when you leave tomorrow, you are the only ones left. They've all gone, they've given up. All right. So, more importantly here, that the mindfulness and the clear comprehension. The mindfulness is to see what is happening. The clear comprehension is to understand the historical and current dynamics of the process. As the Palestinians and any thoughtful Israeli or other will know and need to know, that is just not enough. Mindfulness and clear comprehension is not enough. And we can delude ourselves in thinking that it is. So then has to come with that, coupled with that, which is a proof, an indication of clear comprehension, is right action. It is the action. The action, my view, from a Dharma perspective, there is no affirmation, no justification, and no support for anger and revenge. That is to not cure the problem, it is to perpetuate it. Anger, in Dharma language, whatever it means might elsewhere, in Dharma language, is a poison in the mind, in the heart and mind, in which the intention in the anger is to inflict some kind of pain, hurt, fear upon the other. This is the definition of anger there. But it certainly requires, and revenge is the intensification of the anger. And therefore, that could include killing, assassination, bombing. No matter how intellectually it's done, it's the violence of revenge. It can be an utterly emotionless decision. And expresses the lowest point in humanity. So it needs passion. And the Buddha has spoken of this. Dharma raga. It needs passion. It is the passion of conviction. It is the passion of the action. And it is the passion to use conflict resolution, diplomacy, dialogue, engagement with those whose views are violent and of a completely different persuasion, both within the nation state and outside of it. It needs aid, it needs support, it needs a completely revolutionary way of looking at things, and it needs, since you mentioned the Palestinians, it needs the stopping of the production of weapons and the stopping of the promotion and the export of them. Start putting passion into that, it will change the situation. Not doing that is to perpetuate this nightmare. And that, as I say, it requires passion, and I'm hoping you hear the passion in the voice. Yes, sir.
A couple of days ago, you spoke about your friend couple.
I'm sorry, my
your couple of friends that one of them wants to have a kid.
Yes, right. Yeah, he wants and she says wait. Yeah. Mm.
And then you spoke about the substitute for the love that's not given there. She nourished herself with different kind of.
Right.
So I've got two questions about it.
Please, good.
One, when one is looking for other nourishment,
yes,
isn't it a substitute for the real thing that needed to or needed to be in a relationship?
Yeah.
And the other question that follow it, when is the point in life that you can that you need to move on from relationships with people or with the outside?
Why do I have a question and answer session? Well, I think I'll pass this over. It's called avoidance. Yeah. With regard to the first question, I don't want to go into too much detail because of the confidentiality. But in the most general way, the man in her, they live together, and the man in her life, as I said, really, 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 really wants a baby. He's 30, is there. She, in her work and in her career, and she's doing really precious work, I have to say, is really, really dedicated to this. And therefore, there is a real difference of view between the two. With the differences of view, and remember, it's only her who has spoken to me, so I haven't heard it. The difference of view, she finds that there's a certain tension between them when she comes home. There is a certain coldness, and she said sometimes, because it's there, it easily gets into an argument about. And therefore, as I reported, she feels undernourished. And because of that, she doesn't feel like touch. She doesn't want the man to make love to her. So she just feels that. And it's ongoing between the two of them because it's not resolved. But he also, of course, wants to feel loved and wants to feel nourished there. So I said to her, if you keep looking towards him, given the gap between the two, you'll need the nourishment elsewhere, in the ways that I reported the other evening, through the senses and friendship and silences and much else. That nourishment there. So if that nourishment is coming in, it's not an escape, it's not an avoidance, but at least there is some possibility that you can come home. You feel nourished, and therefore you're not demanding or expecting him to change. And that's the important there. The second with the question, and genuinely is a difficult question, sometimes the mind and the feeling genuinely don't know, should I stay or should I go? It's a very common dynamic. And sometimes the decision which is made, let's say to stay or to leave, whichever one it might be, must have some risk to it. One's decided this or that. It's got to have some risk. And the risk is that in the present, near present, or future, some doubt may come whether I made the right decision. And sometimes we have to live with those decisions that we have made there. The one who makes a decision to leave in a relationship, it easily happens, but it's one of those things which is not necessarily true, that it looks like, from the outsider, it's easier for the one who makes a decision to end the relationship than it is for the one who is on the receiving end of the information. And the one who is on the receiving end of it, he or she may feel, well, my voice wasn't accepted or wasn't included or wasn't part of the discussion. She or he has left me. And sometimes our sympathy may go to the one who's left behind, assuming it's not domestic violence, it's just interpersonal, whatever it might be. But from my listening, and I can literally say thousands upon thousands here, it is not an easy decision to make for the one who leads. It might seem she or he has got the power, I am leaving you, and the other hasn't got the choice there, but it often happens, and often, not very occasionally, it often happens, the one who leaves may say later, oh my God, I made an incredible mistake. I should not have done this. It was really stupid of me. There I wasn't patient enough, I wasn't loving enough. So for the one who is left behind or the one who departs, for both, it really can be challenging. That's the risk in ending of a relationship or in keeping it. It's called life. Yeah. Yes, please.
Can you hear me?
Very well.
So, I have a person in my life.
Yes.
She's very dear to me.
Mm-hmm.
And he lives years in a big circle of anger and self-blame and blame other and shame and a lot of very bad feelings about himself and about the world. And I care about him very much, and I feel I tried everything I can to change it. I tried to give him his time and be receptive about it, and I try to show him that it's hurting me, and I try to make him see the good in it and be criticized to him and just leave it. And I feel I tried everything, and it's caused me a lot of pain, and it's still causing me a lot of pain, and I feel it's causing him a lot of pain, and I don't know what to do now.
Yeah.
Because I don't want to accept it. I really feel that it's a mission I need to complete in my life. Without it, my life won't be peaceful.
Beautiful expressions here of love, which you made reference to a few, of connecting with the person, giving lots of attention to the person, which is love, giving him support through words, the kindness of encouragement, nourishing him so that he perhaps will have a more happier view of himself, of his capacity to hear your good voice, and the larger picture a clearer view about life as well. And that's what love and friendship and the acts of kindness do, in spite of the sometimes very heavy walls of the self, of anger, blame, fault-finding, negativity, contraction, and all that which is like armor around the person and somewhat trapped in all of this. If you reach out, which is precious, in that direction, but it is then at some cost to you in terms of bringing about suffering for yourself there, that suffering will gradually and slowly weaken your mission. You'll give up. The suffering which starts to arise that you can't change this person, that arises within, will gradually grow and get bigger to the point you can't see the other person's suffering any longer because there's too much going on with you in relationship to him. Putting it directly, you are not getting what you want from him, which is some change there. But if you can really keep your sense of connection and presence clear here, your heart clear, the openness that you communicated, and really, really steady, and not giving him the power to make you suffer because of how he is. If you don't give him that power, then that would give you the capacity to sustain and continue the communication with him. And of course, for the renewal purposes, there is life outside this man. A lot. And therefore, to really remember a sky above, earth below, and an amazing amount going on. And it's a good mission. Nice. Yes, sir.
Hey, I have a question.
Please.
About, yes. I have a question.
The young
about
and the older are right here. 18 to 82, is it? 84. 18
wow.
to 84. Here are they. Here they are, the generations meeting. No. Go on, yes. Go on.
So, you said like about the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Yes.
If we'd be more mindful and clear
yes.
with each other, so we'd have and better communication, then we could figure it out.
Absolutely.
So
a lot better.
But I have a question.
Yeah, please.
In very big companies and countries, and that you never have just one or just a couple of people
mm.
control, it's like a lot of bureaucracy.
Yes.
Yes. So can they really be mindful? I mean, can really a huge amount of people communicate with each other when they don't know each other mindfully? Like two countries or Apple and Google. Can you really expect...
We won't get too ambitious. We'll carry on.
Can you really expect Google to be mindful with people? Can you really expect them to understand people and not just follow protocols to how to make money?
Can you repeat the question?
Yes. So the question is, can we, either large companies or very large corporations...
Or countries. Like big organizations.
Or big organizations bring mindfulness to it. What they do. Yes, definitely, everything is possible. I have a would be near to a miracle, but it is possible. I had a rather amusing, I felt, it was an amusing incident. Google has these international conferences called Wisdom 2 on mindfulness and other themes. And something like 17,000 employees in Google in Silicon Valley and San Francisco have done these mindfulness courses at these conferences. And they invited this fella to be a speaker. So they always held them in San Francisco, and then they decided to make them more international. And one of the first places they choose was Tel Aviv. So they were, you know, kindly would have been keynote speaker there. So I wrote back and said, yes, I'm come, but environmentally, just to come and give a talk on an aeroplane, I don't do. But if you allow me to give a talk, and then in one of the side rooms in the conference center, people can come and I can say have 1 hour with them in the side room, maybe it would be worthwhile. Perhaps something a good communication could take, and etc. There. And so there was a little bit email exchange. And then they dropped the invitation. And not because of the request, I suspect they read my blog of my views about Google. I'm sure that's what happened. So the Google world and the corporate world in general is genuinely bringing a lot of mindfulness. But the mindfulness is in a rather exclusively stress reduction form, which is helpful and valuable and genuinely for the usually management there. But the mindfulness which we explore here, as we said at the beginning, carries ethics. Ethics is the looking and the discussion in the corporation of the treatment of factory workers in China, in India, in Bangladesh, at their working conditions, their wages, what is taking place. Mindfulness is looking at the company's relationships to its resources, environmental resources, and what is happening to those resources. Mindfulness includes the massive and obscene tax avoidance running into billions of dollars of Google, Microsoft, Amazon, and the rest of them. That money, which is being taken, because it's tax avoidance, from services which could help the poor, the health services for the sick, the environment, the infrastructure, and these huge corporations hold all of that for their own egotistical, selfish ends, while the gap between the employers, the CEO, who is earning and made billions, and literally billions there, while the poor factory workers are slaving away 60 to 70 hours a week on terrible working conditions and on a very low living wage. There. When mindfulness goes into these places and starts addressing this, then we've got a proper mindfulness. Then we're talking mindfulness. We're not at the moment.
But can it happen?
Everything, I just say, everything can happen if one's a revolutionary. But if one's playing nice, not a chance. And we've got, like as we discussed there, we've got to find our voice. We've not to be afraid of questioning. We've got to protest. We've got a right to say this is unethical. It's manipulative, it's exploitive, and it's a structure which is unhealthy for all of us, and particularly for our poor citizens. And that's where we've got to keep putting pressure. And I was wonderful. I cheered in my living room, watching on the TV, when one of the seniors in the European Commission, this wonderful woman there, just spelt out what these companies like Google are doing there. sentence after sentence. I said, go on, keep going, etc. She did. She scared the shit out of that company. And I said, God, marvellous. So you get the point. Right. Yes, anyone, please. Yes, please, yes.
You just said the word riots, right?
No. I missed the word.
You just said the word riots.
Right.
But that's not violence.
Well,
it's
tell
not
me
about,
the... Yes,
riots is not about violence and anger
Did I say the word riot or
riot?
Riot.
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 Did I say the word riot?
Riot.
Riot.
Yeah. Yes. To go outside and
you said
and, you know.
Riot. No, I didn't think, I don't, wait a minute, I didn't hear it myself. and I was fairly close to the voice, so I have to say, maybe I should get closer there. What I did say, sometimes our empowerment is to protest. We have a human right to act. There is no point, as the good person said a few moments ago, of just being mindful and clear comprehension without the action. So action means that we, women and men of the earth, we get together and we say, this needs to change. And significant, meaningful, non-violent change has come about through men and women coming together, quite often just sitting around a table, having a coffee together, and just saying, we have to do something. And that voice I belong to, I have no faith in the political structure. None. Left, right or centre, none. I only have faith in the empowerment of small and large groups of people to implement change. And all meaningful change has never come from the top. It's come from women and men who said, enough is enough. And that's what
I
with passion.
Okay. That's a way of putting your energy on that and
yes.
saying, no, you're not good, you're blah, 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 you're
no,
bad,
no.
you're doing...
I'm not saying that, but you are.
Okay, that's different.
Okay.
You didn't use those words. And my question is, isn't it better to take this energy? Because they have their money because we pay them. We pay the Apple, we buy their Windows, we buy the computers, we buy the apps, like the phones from these companies. The same thing as food, same thing as everything. We give them the energy with money. But if we take this money and you put in small communities or small companies that do other things, isn't it a little bit smarter, easier, and for the long run, more?
A very good point, but in exploration of this, I think every exploration is worthwhile. I can't see one single answer to it. So if we can just, as you point out, just find ways, you know, to look at where we spend our money, who it goes to, etc. And though we may use, in this case, software or phone or whatever it might be, still I think there's still a place for the really valid voice of real concern for our citizens and our animals and our environment, and to see what steps we can take to give support to a healthier world. And that is part of the engagement with life. Not everybody will be in the political world, in the social world, or corporate protest there, and there are people in this hall here who genuinely, of course, talking to you over the days, who really are doing really incredibly important work in their communities and through their skills and knowledges of mind and body and life and death and situations. And we need equally to give a real lot of support to all these important healthy, life-supporting initiatives, the arts and creativity, and generate a culture of that. And some of us are political. Just 2 or 3 weeks ago, one evening in Totnes, town of 8,000 people, I'm at the PSG meeting, Palestinian Support Group. One of our team in the group had just been to Jenin for 3 weeks and had spent 3 weeks in the Freedom Theatre. You know, the lovely director was assassinated some years ago, and spent 3 weeks as a community there, and particularly with the Freedom Theatre, and really learnt a lot. She came back with a short film. We discussed it and explored it and shared it together. And if I may say for myself, I've been going to Palestine for the last 25 years, mostly to Nablus. So I know that culture fairly well. And the following evening, I'm at a meeting for Combatants for Peace, which has been initiated by Israeli ex-combatants, setting up programs there in Britain and elsewhere to find peaceful negotiations to the resolution. The next evening with the Israelis and friends of Israel, and we're exploring that. And I think this is the kind of way where we free ourselves from the bias, one way or the other, and in that just look at the deep concerns of both communities with action.
Can I add something?
No.
Just, it's beautiful adding about the Palestinian.
Beautiful, sure. Would make it very beautiful.
It will be amazing. 3 more things that I know about the Palestinian Arabs. The teenagers are studying, talking on Facebook, Palestinians and Arabs, and studying communication and seeing the problems on each side. It's also one thing that's happening.
Yeah.
And the other thing are two parents that lost kids through the war. They connected. One is Palestinian, one is Jewish. It's they find and they try to connect people through their pain. And the third group that I know, see how fast I am? The third group is about, it's called Army of Peace.
Mm-hmm.
And it's from the Palestinians which were in Hamas, and they just left it and they just try to communicate and still doing the connection and tell the story.
Lovely. All of that is precious way forward. Any other questions, please? Yes.
Thanks God, I feel very calm and quiet.
Yes, all right. should bring
I
you
have a compliment from you that I'm slower than the ants. faster than me. I just want to ask you how I keep this quietness.
Sounds like the left is saying emigrate. No. Whether we can actually keep something. Already a little uncertain, but what does contribute, as you just said, I walk slowly, I see more, and I feel more protected to the ants. It's a symbolic statement of mindfulness with care in it. Remember that, you'll keep your peace. Yes, sir.
First of all, small inquiry. I wanted to go to this Wisdom 2.0 convention.
Oh, did you?
And the ticket was like 2,000 shekels, or 3,000 shekels. So it's good that you didn't go. And the second, I didn't want to have a mindfulness. So, my inquiry is about procrastination.
Yes.
About what?
Procrastination. Yes. Or if I can elaborate. About sometimes we make a decision, we make an action, and we know it's the wrong action.
Yeah.
But we still do it, though we know it's the wrong action.
Mm.
Do you have any words about it?
Yes, sure. So the first point was on the Google. I had an opportunity to go there, And the cost was 2,000 to 3,000 shekels.
Yes.
And one of my dear friends, who was one of the organizers, emailed me after it, and emailed me, said, this is an organizer. It was good you didn't come, Christopher. You didn't miss anything. I like the honesty. There's a good Dharma wallet. So one has this to watch the view a little bit. So what do I mean by that? There is the intention to act. Prior to the act, it is important, bottom line question, is the act ethical? Ethical action means there is no wish, as far as one can see and understand, to deliberately or intentionally harm or exploit or get revenge or whatever.
No, you're talking about washing the laundry, about doing homework, about
things,
not...
So in that, just the normal conventions of life, so it wouldn't include right and wrong, would it? You don't wash up and say, well, that was wrong. You know what I mean? In the small things of life, right and wrong, doesn't really enter into it, but the procrastination of the small things which you're referring to, the intention matters. So as a small example, well, I was in a relationship with Nina from Sweden, and just absolutely five star, cream of the milk, lovely, lovely woman there. And we're now very good friends, and all the transitions there. So she was there and I was in England. So LDR, I called it, long distance relationship. LDR. So she would be in my house. And I, whatever, by habit or whatever, or at her place, would start washing the dishes after the evening food. And she would say to me, Christopher, this is our time together. Forget the dishes. And we'll do them in the morning, etc. So sometimes the procrastination is better. It's the right thing to do. So in another relationship, another lifetime, my Granwin, who's the mother of my daughter, and who lives just 10 minutes walk away from me. So we're in a community, and from time to time we'd have a smoke, a roll up. Not weed. In the community, but there. And so the relationship started with her, and she said to me, and she'd never smoked a cigarette in her life, and she said, you've got a choice. We can kiss or you smoke. Well, it's a no-brainer, isn't it? I haven't had a cigarette since that day. Kissing is far better, far more enjoyable than any cigarette. It was easy to let go. No procrastination. Wicked.
Tell, please, do you recommend to teach children or teenagers to meditate? If yes, from which age?
Pregnancy. The question is, do you recommend to teach teenagers or children meditation? And I said, from pregnancy. That's where that one starts. That beautiful expression. The mother, she meditates, the little one settles into all of that. And time to time, quite regularly in fact, you know, what means once or twice a year, a woman will come to the retreat and she's ready. She's right, really, really close. And it's been my long-standing wish for a baby to be born in the meditation room. I can't think of anything better to be more mindful of. Life emerging out of the womb, right? Well, that would be something.
Yeah. Yeah. Do you have any retreats?
You're always pregnant women.
60 babies are born.
Exactly. Yes, yes, yes. So, with the good question. So, one of our beloved meditation teachers here began giving meditation mindfulness classes years and years ago.
Simi.
And when she started, it was really rare. Was, you know, I mean, she was a pioneer in starting this with children. She didn't explain, and she'd been a Buddhist nun for 4 years, and that's where she did much of her practice in Thailand. And she just taught the kids. You know, what we are doing without the long 45-minute talk. And she would do different practices with them, and there's now other teachers using. So you might take a flower and hold the flower and just breathe in the fragrance of the flower. See, it helps the focus and concentration. The children would lie on mats on the floor. These are like 5, 6, 7, 8, you know, youngsters with mats on the floor. And there would be two children at each end. So one child would hold the hand of one child and feel the contact, moment to moment, mindful of the contact of his or her hand with the other little child, and then the other child. And the other two kids would be at the other end, just holding each foot, yeah, and other practices. By the end of the term, there, the fear and the bullying in the class had gone down dramatically. The children were much more connected to each other, and I mean, she had something like 6 or 7 invitations to other schools, you know, coming in within a term or two. When I was a monk, ordination was at 5 years of age, the novices there. There were novices who had a lot of wisdom and understanding there, who, as here, the teacher sits higher to get the voice over, and he would invite some of these novices, a boy or a girl, to sit up front and give the evening Dharma talk. 7 or 8 years of age. Wow, and they were good. We should not make too big a gap between the adults and the children, as our society has done. And when our yatra, we have the 15 children around, for when I meet with the children on the walk in France, about 15 kids, age from about 3 or 4 up to 16. Then, of course, tell a story, etc. But then I start asking questions. And, well, those children, the deep things that come out of them, you know, it's precious and beautiful. And Alexander, who's a beloved friend of mine, he is the head doctor of a children's hospital in Germany. And he and I see each other like, for 25 years. We've been very, very good friends, and he's been very good support with the family, I must say. And he, in his working with children, he's writing a book at the moment on that children, sometimes very young, do ask some of the most deep and profound questions about life. They really want to know. They all sorts of things. And sometimes the parents, oh, don't ask me, I don't know. We should try to make sure we do know. Yeah, kids ask us a question, find out, Google it, do something, even Google it, so that we know that we are interested in these deep questions of life that the children ask. And Alexander's writing a book from his conversations over the years and the deep questions the children ask and the stories, etc. It's a lovely title. The title of the book is not out yet, it's called The Buddha's Children. Nice. We are kind of Buddhist children. Anyway, a couple more questions? Yes, please.
Those kids, hasn't lost something from their childhood?
I'm sorry, can't hear. Can't hear, I'm sorry.
Didn't those kids, the Buddhist young ones, lose something from the childhood?
Did they lose something of the childhood?
Yeah.
It may be. It's an important question. In the tradition, some of the children, the young ones, some of them, of course, were orphans. They had nowhere to go. So they came to the monastery, and they lived in the monastery, and they, some of the youngsters told their parents at a young age, I want to go and live in the monastery. And they were quite clear about it. So the monk says, oh yes, past lives. And play is important to child existence. Of course it is. And the novices, the youngsters in the monastery, help to keep us in touch with the child inside ourselves. They'd be running round with the wheelbarrows, filling them up with leaves and chasing the dogs around. You know, all fun would be going on. They had a good time, the novices. But it's not always the case. And in some monasteries, Tibetan monasteries, Thai monasteries, there is a kind of discipline, authoritarianism that can go on. I think it's, of course, obviously very, very unhealthy. And there is a forgetfulness of the play of the child. And adult values are imposed upon the child. And that, to me, is robbing the child of play. And I've said to plenty of people over the years on these areas, because it can happen as well, it's never too late to have a childhood. Never too late. And when one person came and said that, in this case, her mother, was very demanding and very difficult, and mother's always saying, "What, you don't realize all that I've done for you," all this kind of pressure. And the good lady, the daughter, came to me and she said, "Well, what do I do? My mother is ringing me up, she's saying I'm not giving her enough time and attention, she's putting a lot of pressure on me, what should I do?" I said, find a new mother. Why not? If this one's not working, find a new one. And she was a little raised her eyebrows, you know, because she hadn't heard that before. And a few weeks later, the woman was in Israel, by the way. A few weeks later, she emailed me and she said, Christopher, I am so happy. She said, she was in her early 30s, and she said, there is a woman in my office who's in her mid to late 50s, and she said, I just love this woman so much, and I really feel I can talk to her. I can just share. I can't do it with my mother, but I can just share my feelings, my experiences, my life. And she really listens to me. So she put an email. I went to her one day and I said, would you be my mother? And the woman, the office manager, said, I would love you as my mother. So there's mother and daughter. And she said, the incredible difference is that my earthly mother, my family mother, she said, my quote-unquote mother, she can go on and on as she left. And she still does. But she said, I'm not affected by it anymore. I just listen that this is a rather, you know, troubled and worried and demanding person, and this is how she is. And I don't get upset with her anymore. It just stopped. And so I can go and visit her, I can listen, I can pick up the phone there when she's ringing 20 times a day, whatever it might be. And then I just go and talk with my mother in the office. Human beings, we can do anything. Why not? Okay, last question. Yes, sir.
I have a question about the climate change.
Yes, please. Mm.
So, according to projections, in 2015, there's going to be 9 billion people on Earth.
2050 or 15?
2050.
Yeah, right. Okay.
So, a mindful person would bring 2 children, 3 children to the world, while religious people bring 10, 11, 12.
Very naughty.
So, how can we sustain all this?
The I don't know how it quite is in Israel, but in I can just speak from European experience here. The questions around population growth, it could reach, would reach at the present rate 9 million in around 35 years' time, 2050.
Billion.
And with in the current dynamics of it, in secular culture, there is a tendency towards the 2.2 children there. And as you point out, in religions, in the plural, there's a different point of view with sometimes quite large families growing for all sorts of motivations. And I say it's religions that tend to be engaged in this. With climate change that's going on, I noticed that there's been a shifting from to a 2 degree concern about increasing climate to the point of 2 degrees would be a critical there. But this is a shift. In fact, the more critical is around the 1.5 level, and we are around that at this time right now. It's not that the crisis is ahead, we're experiencing it already in different ways. Part of the problem in Europe there is some hesitation and fear about really looking at population growth. It's almost a no-no to really address, except in the most general terms. And it's got to be, I feel, part of the dialogue. We have to look at this situation of population growth and the use of resources and make it a high, essential political agenda. And there's a terrible hesitation to do it because of the obsession with economic growth and the significant increase in the size of families. And that's trouble.
Trouble ahead.
Trouble ahead, yeah, yeah. Yeah. All right, enough. Thank you for all the precious and wonderful and broad expanse of questions from the inner to the outer, the inner and the outer. And let's keep these questions really alive inside and explore and look and discuss and try to keep all these issues, these human issues, really on the agenda. And for that, it really needs our voice. It really does. Let's have a quiet minute together, shall we? Thank you. May all beings live mindful lives. May all beings be fully engaged with the world. May all beings live with love and liberation.